Okay, welcome to today's Q&A session. There's more than one question today. To warn you, I give short answers. Sometimes, a lot of the time. Maybe if we get through them, you could ask if there's still time, you could ask a question in person. How do I put the Four Noble Truths into practice in daily life? This is suffering. This is the cause of suffering. This is the cessation of suffering. This is the path leading to the cessation of suffering. So it's Four Noble Truths is a framework for seeing our own experience. So what we want to do, we want to develop wisdom to have a sense of ease and letting go. And to do that, we have to see the suffering of these different mental obscurations, like anger, for example. That's the easiest one to use as an example because it's usually the clearest that when we let it go, there's ease and happiness. So seeing the suffering, seeing the dukkha, seeing the unsatisfactory nature of things, that's the first noble truth. Four noble truths, in order to think about it in a very simple and succinct way, is that the Buddha's just declaring that there is something, and then he's saying this is the cause of it, and this is the cessation of it. So it's caused by something, and it ceases when those causes are lifted. And the path, we could talk for months about the path, so I won't go into it so much here, but it can be distilled into sila, samadhi, panya, virtue, meditation, and discernment. So the way you put it into practice in daily life is just to see when you suffer. So it's actually too obvious. That's why we don't see it. The reason we're not able to put the Four Noble Truths into practice is it's actually too obvious. So, for example, when we feel a sense of dis-ease or dissatisfaction, habitually we're trying to pin it on something outside of ourselves. So that experience is arising for us, but we're always pinning it on something outside of ourselves, whether it's a friend, family, world, political situation, whatever, we're always pinning it on something outside of ourselves, and that's where the suffering is coming from. That's where our sense of dis-ease and dissatisfaction is coming from. Four Noble Truths, when we learn how to use it in practice, is this is suffering. So we just say, this is suffering. And then the Buddha said the Buddha radically said that the cause of suffering is tanha, is craving. Kama tanha, bhava tanha, vibhava tanha. So that's craving for sensual, any sense, not just sense pleasure, but craving for the senses to be a certain way. Bhava tanha, craving to, like, becoming. Vibhava tanha, the craving to not exist, to not be. So those three types of craving. But actually, we can just think about it as wanting things to be other than what they are. So that's the easy way to think about it. So say in our daily life, we have a sense of dis-ease. And when we see and acknowledge that, then we can say, well, this is because I want something to be other than what it is right now. Things are this way and I don't want it to be this way, but it is this way. So things are this way and I don't want it to be this way. And then when we think about the Buddha, oh wait, that's what the Buddha was teaching. That when you want something, to be different when you want something not to be that way, it's suffering. So that's how you use the Four Noble Truths in daily life, is you bring it back to your own experience, that it's arising inside. It's not coming from elsewhere. Other things outside might act as corollary causes or side causes, but the experience is arising for us. And so we look at that desire for things to be other than what they are. Can you talk more about the shift from feeling unsafe to feeling safe? So that's like taking refuge. This is one of the questions from online. So refuge is a place of safety. And when we don't yet have that place of safety, we seek it in all sorts of things. And because they're not a true refuge, we don't yet feel safe. So something I was thinking a bit about last night, talking a little bit about taking refuge in awareness. So there's safety in that non-judgmental awareness. That's one. This is actually a difficult question because there's so many causes and conditions that come into play in terms of feeling unsafe. And it's similar to that contemplation of the Four Noble Truths. We might pin our feeling of unsafety on something outside. But actually there's a lot we can do. You know, if there's some sort of situation we're in where we don't feel safe, we can actually set the intention to try and leave that situation or get out of that situation. Setting the intention, setting the motivation to move in a good direction is very, very important. And it all comes back to dukkha and the unsatisfactory nature of existence in general. So, say during the whole last year with the pandemic, people might feel very unsafe. Or people might express that they feel unsafe. But this is just, if it's not one thing, it's another. So even outside of this particular strange time in history, people get various illnesses or have accidents, and there's always tragedies happening. Sandra actually came up with some words of wisdom a couple days ago when she was showing her brother-in-law here at the monastery, and we were talking about the fires, how they have these fires locally, and Sandra said it. Being alive has many inherent risks. Just being alive has many inherent risks. And so if we aren't able to come back to taking refuge in something stable, like knowing and awareness, then it is risky. It's risky to take refuge elsewhere. That can lead to a place of, like, a feeling of safety. So in the shift of feeling unsafe to safe, it's like shifting refuges from something that's unstable, like something outside of ourselves that we can't control, to something stable, like awareness, which is always there, always accessible. When living with others, we tend to stick with our perceptions, our belief, causing potential conflict with them. In our practices, how can we accept others as they are and be able to live with others harmoniously? This is like monk friend of mine, Ajahn, an abbot in Thailand, Ajahn Achalo, he translates metta as non-judgmental awareness. So I really like that translation, that non-judgmental awareness, accepting people as they are. And this is a good question, because with our perceptions, sometimes we underestimate how powerful perception is. Perception can be. When we meet somebody else, we're not actually meeting them, we're meeting a perception of them. So we may even meet somebody for the first time, and we already might have a perception of them based on something they've said, or it could be even something really small, and we develop a perception of someone. And then when we talk to them, we're talking to our perception. We're not talking to them directly. Or when we, these perceptions, this edifice of perception, that we start to dismantle it with knowing and awareness. So non-judgmental awareness is a great way to have goodwill, and people will feel that. So a lot of times, young people in America will feel comfortable around someone because they'll say, it's because I feel like they're not judging me. So I feel like they're not judging me. Or I don't feel judged when I'm around that person. So it's not uncommon that you hear young people say that. And usually that person will have a sense of non-judgmental awareness, just accepting them as they are. That also leads to that place, feeling of safety, creating that feeling of safety for others. That's an act of generosity. Non-judgmental awareness is abhayadana. That's the gift of fearlessness, gift of safety. How should a person cope with loneliness or fight the feeling of being lonely without having to rely on other things / people / contact / sensation? Thank you. Yeah, loneliness is an interesting one. I'm not sure if what's exactly meant by fight the feeling of loneliness. You can be aware of it. You can be aware of the feeling of loneliness, just like being aware of any other feeling. Loneliness is interesting because it's not necessarily associated with being alone. So people might have the experience of being alone and they don't feel lonely, they feel held or full or fulfilled. Or you might have the experience of being at a big party or gathering and you feel more lonely than ever. So I think of loneliness as alienation, like a sense of alienation. That's very much connected with loneliness. And I remember just being in a cave in Thailand, just on retreat, and I remember at the end of the retreat reflecting that I never once felt lonely while I was in this cave, and just doing the practice and feeling very whole and feeling quite good about the practice, but not feeling lonely, but being in a very lonely, what people would consider a very, very lonely place. And people were actually bringing food to me. I wasn't even going down. The other monks were bringing food up, and there was a bell outside of the cave, and the bell would ring, and I would just go out, and since it was a bhikkhu bringing it up, it would already be offered. So I wasn't even going down. This was at Pujamgom, not even going down for the alms round for 2 weeks. And so there, if you think of the opposite of loneliness, there's that feeling of being held. So I felt very like being held by the environment there, and it was this very beautiful natural environment, very good weather at the time, not too hot, not too cold, feeling very comfortable. But then sometimes the loneliness can arise really strong, like depending on our temperament. It could be when we're in the city or when we're around a lot of people, then we might feel unsafe. Or all these questions are connected, because there's loneliness is also that feeling of not feeling safe. But sometimes loneliness is because we're by ourselves or we're missing people. We want to hang out with our friends or whatever, and we're lonely, so we call our friend up, hey, let's go hang out. But that doesn't really get at the heart of the problem. So go hang out, go watch a movie or something. You know, it might alleviate it for a while just by not looking at it with awareness. But to really get to the heart of the problem, we look at it with awareness and try to see what's the deeper issue here, and trying to get to the heart of the problem. But we don't really have to fight with it. That's more like repression. We don't want to repress or deny what we're experiencing. So we want to see it with awareness, see it with mindfulness and awareness. Buddhism is all about seeing everything with mindfulness and awareness, and looking at what's it stemming from, what's it coming from. So it's not about getting rid of it. It's just acknowledging this is the way things are, this is how it is right now, and it's unpleasant, and looking at how it is. And that's what we call the contemplative practice as well, when we just look at it and see our awareness is just like this, and in this moment it can't be any other way. Seeing it with awareness does start to change it. In it's one of those practice paradoxes where seeing it with awareness and non-judgmental awareness, it does actually start to change it. It starts to calm down, it starts to settle. What is the attitude to have to others who are not on the path but are close family members? They might be on the path, you never know. Non-judgmental awareness. Yeah, also just that's how we, you know, if we talk about bringing people to the path, all it means is bringing them to a sense of contentment and well-being and awareness, and through that non-judgmental awareness of others is really what sets that example. So if we express something like frustration, they're going to end up thinking, well, I think I'm not so sure about that, if I want to emulate that. But if they see you coming at like with non-judgmental awareness and just being respectful, supportive, respect is a big one. That's the karawa in Pali. Karawa is respect. So that's a very important quality to be cultivating: humility, respect, and seeing good qualities in others that, even though they may not quote unquote be on the path, they may have actually good qualities that are path-like that we can take note of. Can you speak about how to hold both appreciation and gratitude and not lose an awareness of dukkha and understanding of dukkha? Awareness of dukkha doesn't necessarily mean we have to be suffering all the time. So appreciation and gratitude, these are things that naturally arise. If we talk about the course of the practice and how the practice opens up and develops for us, then it's only natural that we'll have a sense of appreciation and gratitude. And having appreciation and gratitude, and say, those are bright qualities, so it's okay to be in brightness. It's okay to be for the mind to be bright and to abide in that. So we don't have to always be contemplating dukkha. We can also be contemplating cessation of dukkha. So we can say, well, that's interesting. These qualities are non-dukkha. These qualities are bright, and there's contentment and brightness. And so that's the third noble truth. So we don't always just focus on the first noble truth. We also focus on the third noble truth, the cessation of dukkha. And so then when dukkha does arise again later on, we say, oh, well, why is dukkha arising? Well, maybe it's because those qualities of appreciation and gratitude aren't present. So then we try to cultivate those qualities of appreciation and gratitude again, because the goal is to stop suffering. That's the ultimate goal, is to find a way to the remainderless cessation of suffering, what we call nibbana. So it's not just being aware of it, but it's being aware of dukkha in a way that does lead to the settling of the mind. When, quote, returning to the knowing, unquote, was described as aware, awake, and bright, I understand the aware and awake, but is the brightness something that comes up naturally because lack of kilesas, or something that the mind is lifted to? Yes. So I guess you could just say yes to both. When the mind transforms or the mind gets bright, yeah, there's a lack of defilements, and also the mind can be lifted up above, out of the muck of the defilements, so that it doesn't necessarily have to be one or the other. It's when the mind becomes bright, it doesn't really matter how it became bright. Just that it's bright, and then we'll see that, say, using the example of anger, I had this experience one time where I was actually irritated and angry and was able to really let go of it, really saw the suffering of it in that moment and was able to let go of it, and suddenly felt very, very happy. And the mind got bright temporarily. And so can't really say it was either lifted up or lack of kilesas. It's kind of both. Lack of kilesas keep it weighed down, keep it heavy. And so it's natural that it's buoyed up or gets lifted up at that moment of brightness. Sadhu, Lungpur, and Ajahns, for all your teachings in the verses of sharing an aspiration, in may they soon attain the threefold bliss and realize the deathless. What are the threefold bliss? That's a good one. That's a academic question. That's very good to know, because we just say the threefold bliss, we never really explain it, and that's the, I believe, it's the bliss of good health, so the bliss of health, the bliss of happiness, and the bliss of nibbana. Is that right?
There's probably all sorts of different things.
Yeah.
Oftentimes it's like for the happiness of the world,
oh,
as well as a heavenly happiness,
mm-hmm,
and then the happiness and bliss of Nibbana.
Worldly happiness, heavenly happiness, and bliss of Nibbana.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I know in Thai they call it Lon, Sam Lon, mm, and I remember that. I think that's where I got the health, mm, one was Prapayuto. So could be either of those, the worldly happiness, heavenly happiness, and the bliss of Nibbana, or it could be good health, or just all types of happiness. So threefold, meaning just everything, all types of happiness. Could you suggest some inquiry questions to contemplate in investigating and realizing the wisdom practice of equanimity? Equanimity, traditionally, it's normally cultivated by the contemplation of kamma. So it's the traditional phrase is, I'm the owner of my kamma, heir to my kamma, born of my kamma, related to my kamma, abides supported by my kamma, whatever kamma I shall do, for good or for ill, of that I will be the heir. And then we apply it to others as well. Others are heirs of their kamma, born of their kamma, related to their kamma, abide supported by their kamma, whatever kamma they will do, for good or for ill, of that they will be the heir. Kamma being action, just actions of body, speech, and mind. And that's traditionally how you cultivate equanimity. So if you want to have inquiry questions, or you could have something like, how am I the owner of my kamma? What does that mean? Looking into that. Also, coming back to that non-judgmental awareness, like if we think critically of somebody, like asking ourselves, what do I gain? What do I gain from thinking in that way? So it's trying to use those Four Noble Truths, trying to see dukkha. What do I gain from being judgmental of this person? What do I gain from being critical of this person? And inquiring in that way can lead to a sense of equanimity and cooling the mind down. You got a question?
More academic. This is the celebration of the 25th anniversary of Abiyaki Reef, right? And I think it was collective mentioning that when we never thought it's going to be, or intended to be, this what we have now over 25 years. So anyway, my question would be that for the next 25 years, what would be the leading light of the direction of Abiyaki Reef? You probably might say the Dhamma, but you have any? Is there any collective vision of what?
I think this was the vision. I think they've achieved the vision. This
I think. And the next 25 years, what would it be like?
No, build some more tent platforms. Own the whole valley of an empire. It's hard to say. I mean, we're in phase three of our four-phase construction, so there's this building was the building that had to be completed to get out of phase two. And phase three has only one large... There's only one more large building planned for the monastery, and that's the Uposatha Hall, and that's supposed to be up the hill, but we don't really have a timeline for that, or we've started thinking about it a little bit, but in terms of building, you know, that's, as the community grows, we do need a bigger ordination hall or ordination area, and a big, and add that to the monastic area. Otherwise, there's just maybe 6 or 7 more kutis planned, and that's about it.
Yeah, that could take another 25 years.
It could. A chedi, maybe, or something. Yeah. But the Uposatha Hall might actually be the chedi as well. So sometimes, like, combining things together. And otherwise, it's just the whole giving the opportunity for people to ordain and live here and then maintaining everything. It's work to just maintain everything and make sure it doesn't degenerate too much. And we have kept building. We just built this new four-room dormitory called the Brahmavihara, just up the hill, that people are now occupying. So that was just completed. And we're replacing some, there's the 5 original kutis that Longpa mentioned yesterday. It's these 5 original kutis. They were meant to just be temporary for a few years, and they're 24 years old now. So we replaced one, we replaced the log cabin, but we have to replace the other 4. And that's where Ben was staying, was in the log cabin replacement. We call it the Parami Kuti. Turned out to be a very good kuti. Yeah, and there's always going to be little things that happen, like this man wanted to build a pavilion for our little Earth Store Bodhisattva statue. And so that was just done. But yeah, just take it as it comes. And, keep the precepts and just continue on. Or maybe it'll all burn down. And then we have to spend 25 more years rebuilding it. Okay, so, oh, one more question. Yeah.
Is that okay?
Yeah.
What would you recommend I could do to help myself fear death less?
Yeah, that's also to, so question being to fear death less, what can be done? Yeah, just according to the Buddha's teachings, usually to fear death less, we talk about virtue, or what we call sila, and sila being the greatest protection, because in terms of death, there's an intuitive fear that we have about death. So there's, like, we might have regret, or we might have remorse, so the Buddha's recognizing that and saying, well, the best way to die is to die without regrets. And so to be living our life in a way that we don't have regret and remorse, setting that intention to live in a way that's upright with a lot of integrity, and that actually can help quite a bit. According to the scriptures, someone who's attained the first stage of awakening, the stream entry, that first stage of insight where you see impermanence very, very clearly, you see that the body and the mind is itself, you know, impermanence, and that deep insight into impermanence, they say that the fear of death falls away at that time when one sees very, very clearly into impermanence or the unsatisfactory nature of the human condition. But that's also very conceptual, so like we usually take it back to virtue and integrity, and then living in that way can actually help quite a bit. we do death contemplation is a very big contemplation in Buddhism, but we don't want to do death contemplation to the point where we feel really afraid or morose. That's not the aim of it. The aim of it is to bring us back into the present and not be lost too much in the future or proliferating about the past either. So the death contemplation is for bringing us back into the present, to that present moment awareness. But yeah, usually just that focus on honesty as well, honesty, integrity, that... I don't know if Lungpur has anything to say about that as well. We've got a few more minutes.
I don't actually have much more to say because that's a really... it's a really important sort of perspective to recognize is that, you know, so much of our fear of death, worry about death is around what have I left incomplete, or what have I not got, what am I missing, and. And then that ability to return to the recollection that lived really skillfully. I don't have remorse. I don't have regret. I don't have an over inflated expectation of anything. So it's also that seeing things clearly, and particularly seeing that so much of our dissatisfaction or fear comes from trying to get or trying to be what we aren't, and as that's seen more clearly, then there isn't really a basis for fear or worry, and then also that aspect of what Ajahn Yaniko referred to as the that initial liberating insight into Dhamma is also the insight into personality and identity. When we see that all of the things that we build our personal identity with are all impermanent, unsatisfactory, not self, then there's a great relief where the burden of trying to prop up an identity in one way, shape, or form, or trying to run away from a particular identity in one way, shape, or form, those are all constructs that don't really have any substance to them. So then when that's seen, you realize, there's nothing to fear, and there's an ease and a well-being and kindness and compassion that we can take as a bottom line rather than fear and worry.